This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're going to talk with Francis Ford Coppola about how he started making movies. Movies like The Conversation, The Godfather Trilogy, and Apocalypse Now. We're also going to find out about his latest projects. Coppola recently started a literary magazine called Zoetrope All Story, a tri-annual short story magazine. And the big news this week is the reunification and restoration of his Napa Valley winery. In 1975, Coppola and his wife purchased two-thirds of the Inglenook Winery, created by Gustav Niebaum in 1880. The other third of the Niebaum estate was under corporate ownership. A couple of years ago, the Coppolas purchased the remainder of the estate and began restoring it. Saturday night, they'll celebrate the completion of the Niebaum Coppola Estate Winery with a black tie gala benefit, which will include a screening of the silent film Napoleon, accompanied by a live orchestra. The film and orchestra have been held over for a more informal screening on Sunday. Coppola is currently finishing work on his adaptation of John Grisham's The Rainmaker, which is scheduled to open next month. We reached him at his winery and asked him first about the celebration.
I thought, what could be the biggest show and the most wonderful family event that I could create? And, of course, it made me think of the film Napoleon, which our company first brought to the public with a full symphonic orchestra with the music composed by my dad, Carmine Coppola. And I thought, imagine if we restore this castle and there outside under the stars put up the three screens and battery of projectors that it takes to put it on, because as you know, it's in a three-screen format, and get the full symphony orchestra and come up with a Napoleonic feast of, you know, like just a 8-10 course feast with some of the rare wines from our from our cellar that was the old, we still refer to it as the Inglenook Chateau because it says it in the stone and I couldn't take it off, and great rare wines and cigars, and just kind of do a family event, grand opening to the best of our ability. And Marvin Shankin, who's our co-host, we offered it. It has two fine charities that will benefit from the net proceeds, and it's $1,000 a person for a kind of event of a lifetime.
So what wine will you be serving at your
We're going to introduce the 1993 Rubicon, which it'll be the debut of that wine, and then the whole evening will be from the library of the estate. We're going to have in Magnum for the main dinner the 79 Rubicon, which is my you know, it's the oldest of our Rubicon, and many other actual wines that come from the estate itself.
Talking with you about wine makes me think of food, which also makes me think of scenes in The Godfather, particularly one scene that I just want to ask you about related to food. You know, throughout The Godfather, there's always people cooking pasta and sauces. But there's one scene where Hyman Roth, the Jewish gangster played by Lee Strasberg, he's at home and Al Pacino has just come to visit him. And so Hyman Roth offers him a can of tuna fish. That scene always just struck me as so funny after all of this, like, lavish attention to sauces and pastas, the "would you like some tuna fish?" Tell me about that scene.
Yeah, I remember that scene, and we tried as much as possible to make that setting, and Roth's wife, I remember, came in, and she did bring them little tables and bring them tuna fish sandwiches.
Those are little folding tables.
Yeah, they were watching a baseball. I actually like tuna. A well-made tuna fish sandwich is a great thing.
Okay, so you didn't see that as being some kind of contrast in cultural food styles?
Well, for sure, you know, definitely. But I like foods of many cultures, and a tuna fish sandwich sometimes watching a ball game is a very, very, a glass of beer too. It's a great option that we all have.
Okay. Francis Coppola is my guest. And, you know, you have a couple of new projects going now in addition to a forthcoming movie. You know, there's The Winery, and you also have your Zoetrope Literary Journal. It's a short story journal that I believe the function of it really is to be a kind of a testing place for stories that might lead to interesting screenplays.
Well, you know, obviously we would be thrilled if a wonderful short story was published in the magazine that could be a movie, but that's not what the editorial mandate is. They're looking for really, you know, great writing and writing that is about contemporary life and with characters and situations and classic stories. And most of the ones we choose issue after issue are really not immediately translatable into film. We're more interested in setting up a short story magazine that just has great short fiction and hopefully new voices and real voices, because the motion picture methodology for generating scripts is, you know, so small and insular that I thought it would be very stimulating to have a magazine that really reaches out to writers all over the country and the world for that matter, and just good short fiction without the tedious and unnecessary mechanism of a screenplay.
You've said, I've never met a person in the film business who enjoys reading a screenplay. Why not?
Firstly, it's the form. The screenplay form really is not a legitimate literary form. It's like an architectural drawing to put down in a very clear way the givens of the script, so that the production people in the art department can very easily know whether the scene is inside or out, or what type of camera view might be appropriate. It's in other words, in a large part, it's a kind of technical blueprint. And very often, because now writers think that they have to write a screenplay, they go out and they buy a copy of a screenplay, and or they read a book about the format, and so they sort of ape what these technical format is. What happens is the story and the characters start to get lost, and very often the story and the character isn't there, and the format of the screenplay sort of hides that fact. And so I thought that why should writers be working in a screenplay form? That's something that can be done much, much later when the film is trying to broken down and budgeted to really be done. But if the writers write in a story format, a short story format, they can really focus on the character and the theme and the plot, and therefore it's much, much more enjoyable for a person who's reading and trying to get into it.
I'm curious, did The Godfather look like a good screenplay before it was made into a movie?
Well, The Godfather screenplay was made from the novel, and really, I directed the movie as much from my annotated novel. I used to schlep around this big, thick, loose leaf. People have worked in theater know how you make a prompt book and you actually cut the pages of the text out, and so that you can put all the notations on bigger loose leaf pages. And that's what I had done. And I really directed the movie from the novel, but I did write the screenplay. But honestly speaking, no director ever looks at the screenplay and says, "Oh, it says a close shot here. Let's now do a close shot." So it really is a false methodology.
Early in your movie career, you were before you were directing, you were writing screenplays and doing rewrites of other screenplays, being like a script doctor. Were there principles that you learned or you figured out early on that you think still work?
Well, usually, on a technical sense, the script in question sort of starts really 20 or 30 pages after the screenplay or when it's shot, the movie does. And so one of the quick panaceas that the old heads of studios and moguls used to do, and that I have myself found myself doing, is you sort of try to look to the script to where really something seems to be happening and things of interest are starting to coalesce and sort of delete everything before that.
My guest is Francis Ford Coppola. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Francis Ford Coppola is my guest, and he's now celebrating the reunification and restoration of his winery. I'm interested in some things about your family. I think it was your maternal grandfather who actually owned several movie theaters. What years did he own them? Were you alive?
No, this would be really in the 20s, I would guess. And in fact, they not only owned some theaters, and theaters that catered pretty much to Italian-American audiences, but they lived on top of it, and so all the family would have different jobs. My grandmother would take the tickets, and the younger mischievous brother, Victor, people in those days used to put their babies in the lobby, and so that he would walk through and say, baby crying, and they would really run these little theaters. And then from that, he actually began to go to Italy and acquire some films for Italian-American distribution in his company. Also, he did music roles, because primarily he was a, songwriter and a composer, and a wonderful one, I think. And his music role company was called Paramount Music Roles. And some of his friends in that time, in the 20s, were becoming involved in a movie studio. And as the story goes, they were talking to him and looking for a name, and he suggested, we'll call it Paramunto. And that was Balaban and Katz, who later were the partners in what later became Paramount.
That's quite a brush with early movie history.
Well, I have on the other side another interesting story. My other grandfather, Carmine Coppola's grandfather, Augustino, was a very fine engineer and tool and die maker, made mechanical things, and he was called upon to engineer and build a new device that turned out to be the Vitaphone, which was the first sound talkie movie that when they made The Jazz Singer with Al Jolson, it was, and there's in our museum, there's a beautiful museum in the winery, and there's a picture of him with the Vitaphone that he's just built.
Can you sing a verse of a song that your grandfather wrote?
Well, sure, I'll always sing for you. In The Godfather, there was a whole sequence in a little Italian-American music hall where they sang a song that was called Senza Mamma, and it went sort of like, Senza mamma, a quanta foresta parola ancora. Senza, it's all about crying because he ran off with a sort of a woman of no account, and then his mother died.
So that was your grandfather's song?
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
That's a Neapolitan song.
Huh. So I think it was your grandfather who gave you, a 16-millimeter projector when you were a boy?
That's right. In 1949, I had polio and I was paralyzed for a year, and he did bring me a kind of 16-millimeter projector. It was a young people's projector. It wasn't it was a real working 16-millimeter projector, but it was of toy quality, but I used to certainly love that.
So what did you project in it?
Well, unfortunately, because it was 16-millimeter, there were only the couple of little film clips that I had. Most of what film I could play with was an 8-millimeter, and there I had a number of cartoons and some home movies. And also my father had one of the very early tape recorders, the Ecor home tape recorder, and I had it by my bed when I was in that period of being paralyzed, and I used to try to make soundtracks and synchronize them to make them play in sync with the movies.
And what would be on the soundtracks?
Well, it would be stuff like, oh, here we go, hey, Mickey, no, watch out, the fire. It was like that.
So how paralyzed were you?
Well, I couldn't walk, and I couldn't move my left arm.
So you spent a year basically away from the rest of the world.
I was in a bedroom on the second floor. You know, in those days, people were very, very frightened of polio as a children's contagious disease, so I didn't certainly see any kids. I saw my brother and my sister, and I had a television. One of my great frustrations, of course, this is before remote control, was that I wasn't able to get up to change the channel. But I had my favorite shows. There was one called The Children's Hour that Horn and Hardock used to do with lots of talented kids singing and dancing. And I loved that, and some puppet shows.
So did you have any sense at this age that you actually were getting serious about movies?
No, I didn't have a very, important view of myself. I was, I had been always moved many, many schools, so I always kind of was a little bit of a loner, and I had extraordinarily talented and, really a kind of winner older brother who was very kind to me, but pretty much was the star of the family, and so I never thought of myself as, I wasn't good at school, and I wasn't particularly my family was very good looking, all of them, and I was the affectionate one. I wasn't as good looking as the others.
It must have been interesting for you to eventually go from, being paralyzed for a year alone at home in your bed to, being such the center of attention and so famous.
It was totally an accident. It happened because I sort of was a little bit of a boy scientist, and I was very interested. I used to stay by myself in the basement or the garage, whatever. Since we moved a lot, whatever little shop I could set up, and it was my interest in science and electricity, and that got me kind of working on lights and on theater. And then I think my older brother was a writer, and because of him, I heard about things related to literature, and I pretty much wanted to emulate him. So the combination of being interested in stories and literature and lights and theater, and I must say girls, because the girls were at the theater department or the football team.
Right.
So I wanted to, I always was a little bit of an outcast socially because I was the new kid. And I felt if I could hang out at the theater, and of course theater always needs volunteers, and if I was willing to, work and unravel the cable or help build the sets, I could be included in the group.
Your father, Carmine Coppola, who wrote music for The Godfather and for the restoration of Napoleon, was, a professional musician throughout his life, and certainly, while you were growing up. He was a flutist with an orchestra. He played for a while with Radio City Music Hall, accompanying the Rockettes. What were some of the things that seemed really exciting to you about his work?
Well, the most dramatic part of that period as a child was that he was the solo flutist for Toscanini and the NBC Symphony Orchestra. So all during the time that I was a small child, it was a very prestigious, and we were occasionally, there'd be articles in the newspaper about him, and so we knew there was something important going on. Although when I was really little, I used to go around telling everyone that my father was a magician, because I had heard he was a magician, but I got it wrong. He was a musician. I remember one incident that is very vivid in my mind. They took me to the studio and RCA Studio 8H, where the big orchestra and Toscanini with his white hair and black turtleneck was, and I was brought as a five-year-old in a little glass booth, and I was very intrigued because there was a knob in the booth, and when you turned it all the way to the left, you would hear the orchestra, and when you turned it to the right, you couldn't hear the orchestra. I think that's when I first realized as a concept that sound and picture are not necessarily connected. But my dad was more ambitious as a composer. He went to Radio City really as the chief arranger. When he was a young man, he had played there, as did his brother, who later became a conductor there. And so as kids, my brother and I were brought into the back of the stage of Radio City and was shown and sort of had the run of it in a way, and could see the incredible theatrical mechanisms that are back there, and got to go there a lot. And that's one of the reasons when I thought of doing Napoleon with a symphony orchestra, that my dream was to do it at Radio City, which at that time was under real financial pressure. There were even rumors of possibly decommissioning it. And Napoleon was the first event done at Radio City, an outside event that was a tremendous success and put them on the track of doing outside events, which saved the music hall.
I know you were a theater major as an undergraduate. Did you perform in musicals? Did you sing and dance?
I did a few times. My brother's wife was our choreographer, and I would build the sets. And, again, I loved the theater experience of being one of the gang and getting to go with them all after and have coffee. And I did sing and dance and Of the I Sing there was a 40s musical about kids. I forget the name now.
Two of your movies have been war movies, Patton and Apocalypse Now. Were you ever drafted?
No, but one of my school experiences was at a military school. I was at New York Military Academy in high school for a couple of years, and of course I played in the military band, but I was a full-out cadet, and so I knew a lot about, really in a funny way, cadet life, which of course it was a place, that place up there right next to West Point, and I was very good at drill, and I knew all about military organization and stuff like that.
So you liked it?
I did like it. After a while, I felt a little isolated there when an older roommate graduated. He was someone who was, reading James Joyce's Ulysses, and he was a kind of pretty interesting fellow. He was also the only Jewish guy in the school, and I admired him. And then the next year, I kind of felt very isolated and wanted to do interesting things with the theater group there, and they didn't want me to, and I finally ran away.
Ran away from school?
Ran away from military school.
Oh, my gosh. Were you caught?
Well, I did it very effectively. I just called a cab.
But what happened?
I wandered around New York, scared to go home, because my father was on the road with a Broadway show, with a touring show, and I wandered around New York, and I had sold my uniforms to some guy whose brother was going to come the next year, and I had a couple $100s, and I sort of lived this very strange wandering around New York and seeing things I'd never seen before. And then when I got home to where my brother was living with his wife, I told him what had happened. He said, "Here, read this book." And I read The Catcher in the Rye, and I said, "Hey, I just did this." I wrote a letter to J.D. Salinger after reading it, and I said in the letter, "You know, I'm 16 and I want to be a filmmaker, and I've just lived something so much like your book that I know I would do a good job. I wish you would please let me have the rights to make Catcher in the Rye."
Oh, that's a scream. I'm sure you got a lot of response from J.D. Salinger.
Yeah, zero.
Yeah. Francis Ford Coppola will be back with us in the second half of the show. His new literary magazine is called Zoetrope All Story. His next film, The Rainmaker, is scheduled to be released next month. This Saturday, Coppola celebrates the reunification and restoration of his winery in the Napa Valley. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Francis Ford Coppola. This Saturday, he celebrates the reunification and restoration of his Napa Valley winery, the Nebaum Coppola Estate. And his film adaptation of John Grisham's The Rainmaker is scheduled to open next month. We talked about his latest projects and his early career. So you when you decided you wanted to make movies, you went to UCLA for grad school. Did you think that school would help lead to a movie career?
Well, I was a theater major, and as I finished college undergraduate, there was that point in which a lot of people chose, you know, are they going to go to the Yale Drama School? And I was already interested in film, having seen the works of Eisenstein and being very knocked out by them. And I liked that I had stayed in my theater background because I worked a lot with actors and acting, and I felt that would be very valuable for the kinds of films that I wanted to make. And I chose the UCLA Film School. In those days, it was, you know, kind of the famous one and supposedly the very good one. And then I left in around 1960 and went out to California.
Your early movies include, you know, on the one hand, The Terror, a Roger Corman production with Jack Nicholson. And what's it called with Fred Astaire?
Phineas Rainbow.
Phineas Rainbow, yeah. So, you know, the young Jack Nicholson on one hand, Fred Astaire on the other, a musical on the one hand, and Roger Corman on the other. It seems like an interesting mix.
Well, that was an interesting period back there in the beginning of the 60s. I was in film school. I was very poor. I had come from such a wonderful period of working in theater at Hofstra College in the East Coast and having the chance to direct, you know, original musicals. And I did Streetcar Named Desire, and I was became, you know, like at schools, there's always the boy wonder who has the keys to everything and runs the drama organization. So I went from a period of great kind of probably greater power than I've ever achieved in the years later. And suddenly I was all alone in California in a much more solitary kind of work. The film students at UCLA were all locked in their rooms, you know, using the pecking order, who got the moviola equipment, who didn't. And it didn't have the warmth and the camaraderie of theater. And so I was very, very depressed and very, very poor, and just started to try to get any kind of work I could. And there's a film that is out that has my credit as the director of, called Tonight for Sure, which was a little nudie film. The truth is that it was a German nudie film, and I was hired to kind of do the English subtitles and edit it. And since I was the editor, when it came time to put the credits on, I just wanted to see it. So I put it directed by Francis Ford Coppola, just because I was the one who got to make the decision. And of course, that's for years, people always said, "Yeah, I saw your first film." And I sort of say, "Well, you know, I really didn't make that film. It was made in Germany, but I did put my name on it. So I guess it's mine for historical purposes."
However, you did make a couple of other nudies, didn't you? The Peeper?
That was really the one. What I had done is I had made a little short that was this little kind of little silent, cute little silent film, like a little silent comedy, and then this company bought it and hired me to integrate my 12-minute film into this really horrible nudie film that they had produced. And I was sort of working for this schlock film company, just trying to make, you know, any kind of money. But the funny thing is that since I was the one sort of in charge, I'd always put my name, I would always get a beautiful main title, just because, I don't know, in those days it didn't really seem as though the young people were ever going to really get to make film. Usually in UCLA, you would end up working for the USIA or do government documentaries, and so it was a fantasy to see your name as, you know, directed by, it looked like a dream.
Tell me a little bit about how you integrated your 12-minute film into this nudie film.
Well, it was a short comedy, just a little like Tom and Jerry cartoon, and the movie they had made was about a cowboy who falls on a rock and keeps seeing cows as naked girls. And it was really terrible. And my job was to sort of spice up their film with, like, keep cutting back to this character and, you know, figure out a cockamamie way that it could all, you know, so that, you know, they bought my film for $500 or something, and they were going to pay me a few hundred dollars if I did it. That's the one that everyone refers to.
Where did it play?
I have no idea, really.
What kind of theaters?
No. That was the beginning of the soft porn business. The great film was The Immoral Mr. Keys.
Right, that was a Russ Meyers movie.
Right, and so that they began to, for the first time, allow nudity in theaters, and that's what these sleazy companies were just trying to do whatever they could to have something.
Francis Ford Coppola is my guest. Since you really like singing and dancing so much, what was it like for you to work with Fred Astaire in 1968?
Well, it was, you know, he was such an elegant, interesting man. The movie was a bit of a kind of a low budget. The idea was to take the Camelot sets and sort of just fake it. And then they got Fred to agree to be in this old musical and get a kid who could do it. It was a very inexpensive film. And, of course, I at that point wanted to do, you know, serious, original movies, you know, for my own screenplays, but I was so, you know, I had come out of a musical tradition, and I know that, I mean, I thought that, gee, Finian's Rainbow has such gorgeous songs. I didn't realize it had the dumbest book, you know. So I sort of inherited this kind of chestnut, low budget, but it was a pleasure to work with Fred. He was just a very charming man, very hardworking man, and just the sweetest possible person, and professional, and I learned, you know, kind of many things from him. But by the time I had this little stint, you know, kind of in a big studio where I was obviously just a pawn, I very much wanted to get out on the road and make a real personal film, which I did immediately after that, and I made a film called The Rain People.
So is that when you knew that you wanted your own production company, that you didn't want to just be within what was left of the Hollywood system?
Yeah, I think the experience of making The Rain People on the road with our own lightweight equipment, and I had this very young, wonderful assistant, really, who began for the first time in my life to be like a kid brother, who also shared my film school enthusiasm, and we sort of formulated how we could have a film company with this new equipment and be totally independent and, in fact, be located in San Francisco, which as soon as we got back, that's what we did. And, of course, that was George Lucas.
Of course, with freedom, with creative freedom, comes responsibility, and in this case, the responsibility of running a production company, of dealing with all the finances. I mean, how did you feel about taking that on? It certainly can take up time and distract you from the actual act of movie making.
Well, I had lots of experience running the student organizations in the theater department, so in a way, this new company, which of course was called American Zoetrope, and back in 1969, was very much like the little empire I had at school, and I brought, you know, that, and of course George was very young, so he hadn't worked in theater, and he was much more interested in, you know, cinema and editing and graphics, and we made a wonderful combination, and in fact, Zoetrope was the first independent operation that filmmakers had started, where they own their own facilities and their own sound mixing equipment, which is why the soundtracks that started to come out of our films in San Francisco really changed the definition of what Hollywood soundtracks were.
How?
Well, we became involved in, we believed firmly that the sound was 50% of the cinema experience, and since we owned the mix studio, we began to do extremely beautifully designed soundtracks. And in fact, the phrase sound designer was created by us so that we could employ Walter Murch, who wasn't in the union. and movies like Apocalypse or Star Wars really began to feature these extraordinary artistic soundtracks, many of which were done by Walter.
Yeah, who had this almost like psychological insight into how sound is perceived.
Well, now movie soundtracks, of course, have, you know, evolved, and now they're too loud and too assertive. But we always considered that the sound was half the movie experience, and so we gave it a lot of importance. You know, but that was, we did many things. We did many innovative things in those periods as the early American zoetrope, and lots of traditions, some good and some bad, were started by us.
What do you think is a bad tradition that you started?
Well, we were the first company ever to put the entire crew on the end credits.
Oh, wow. You know, some the director of L.A. Confidential, we were just talking about credits at the end, you know, because one of the actress' parents was a caterer back in Australia. Anyways, so we were talking about, do you want to see all those credits at the end or not? So what do you think of that? You think this is especially true in any film that has animation or special effects, the credits last forever.
Yeah, I much prefer the old system. Of course, now the guilds won't let you do it, in which you used to see the credits quickly, and you know, you'd have the photographer and the editor and the composer might be on the same card, and now everyone has to get a separate card. It's just absurd. I mean, now it's 5 minutes of credits. You know, we did it because we were young and poor, and we were very appreciative. We had a small crew, and they had all kind of gone through thick and thin for us, so we had the idea of putting them all on the end credits, and in gratitude, really. But that started to press it. Also, we were the first company ever to give crew jackets as a present to the crew, another tradition which is overworked. We were the first company to ever call a movie Part 2, you know. So we were always innovative.
My guest is Francis Ford Coppola. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Francis Ford Coppola. Michael Schrago recently had a very interesting piece about the making of The Godfather. This is in The New Yorker, and he mentioned that the reason why you made The Godfather is because your film production company was in desperate need of money. You had creditors knocking on your door, and so you might not have ever made The Godfather if you didn't really need money very badly.
Well, my dream as a young person was really to have a career not all that different, except in the type of film, from Woody Allen. I was always one of the directors who was a pretty good screenwriter, and I always dreamed of writing personal screenplays and just making those as my career. But, you know, The Godfather sort of was like really changed my life in many ways. I did do it because we were broke, and of course we've always been broke. We've always been independent. We've never had anyone sponsor us or, you know, ally with us. And then later when we started to get really powerful, then people feared that we were going to demonstrate that filmmakers really didn't need that whole upper apparatus that basically runs everything and takes all the money just because they provide the finance, you know. So the issue of independence and trying to reconcile that with having money is always a tough one.
What was it about The Godfather that made you think, I don't really want to do this, but I'll do it because I have to?
Well, when you read the book, the original book, the story of the father and the three sons, which became the core of the film, was only one of a number of, you know, plots in a big, thick book. There were stories about there were more salacious, more kind of bestseller, kind of junky parts, which Mario no doubt wrote to make a bestseller. And when I first read it, I kind of, you know, as I said, I wanted to write, you know, personal films and artistic films, and I felt that there was a, you know, it was like a Harold Robbins book, or not to put Harold Robbins books down, but then only later when I began to work on it, I realized that the core of the story, if you just eliminated everything else, was like a very classic, beautiful story of a king and his sons, and I began to become interested on that level.
It seems to me you've worked with some, you've just like discovered or you know, had really early on some actors who just became, you know, wonderful. Pacino, De Niro, Robert Duvall, Gene Hackman, you know, in The Conversation. Is that something you've really prided yourself on, is having a sense of...
Oh, yeah. You don't have to stop there. I mean, we gave the first roles to many of the big stars.
Nicolas Cage's early work is in your movies?
Nicolas Cage did three or four movies. Harrison Ford, Tom Cruise, Matt Dillon. This is an enormous list of people now coming, even more recently, people who were in Jim Carrey, Helen Hunt. I mean, most of the important people today in Hollywood worked through opportunities given by American Zoetrope.
So,
why?
Yeah, I'm sure you don't have like a system for discovering actors, but if there's anything you could share about that.
It's that I truly and sincerely believe that all cinema, all theater comes from the two main ingredients, writing and acting. And if therefore, you know, we love writers and I love actors and give them all importance and all consideration and all benefit of the doubt. And if you do that, if you have that attitude, you can't fail but, you know, like uncover wonderful talent.
Compare for me, if you would, the joys and headaches of filmmaking versus winemaking.
They're very similar. Both are very much rooted in the source material. In winemaking, it's the land. It's the microclimate of the land, the unique characteristic of the land that produces the grapes. So you can make, if you have great grapes, which come from great land, you can make mistakes with it, which you can kind of work with through refining and editing. And film, it's the source material again. It's the writing and it's the acting. And if you have that, extraordinary blessing of the talent in the writer and in the actor, then again you can make mistakes with it, but you might be able to work with those mistakes through editing and fining, and then both processes go through a finishing process, which now we're doing on the Rainmaker, John Grisham's Rainmaker, where we're actually blending all the music and sound effects and different elements into a finished product with finesse. And you do that when you finally find the wine and finish the wine and then put it in the bottle and then care for it in the bottle for a number of years. So they're very much parallel art forms.
Is The Rainmaker an American Zoetrope production?
It's a co-production. It's a Constellation Films in association with American Zoetrope.
And tell me why you wanted to do this movie.
Well, you know, it's so tough for a director today. I mean, I'm always trying to work on my own work, and of course the demands of supporting a family, and in this case, you know, finishing up my winery makes it desirable to occasionally get a job. And usually the kinds of jobs that a director can get, you know, are not too interesting or very much the same. There's a big formula kind of thing. So to get a real book, this John Grisham book that was about something interesting, that had viewed the kind of sleazy side of the legal business from the eyes of a young law student, I just felt it had rich characters, and you know, I was grateful to have a piece of work that wasn't some kind of silly formula script with everything blowing up, and I was just very grateful to get the job, to be honest with you.
One last question. Will the characters be drinking wine in The Rainmaker?
In a scene or two.
Okay. Well, I want to wish you a happy opening for your winery.
Thank you.
Congratulate you on the restoration.
Thank you.
Francis Ford Coppola celebrates the reunification and restoration of his winery, the Niebaum Coppola Estate Winery, this Saturday. His next film, an adaptation of John Grisham's The Rainmaker, is scheduled to be released next month.